Welcome to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. I'm your host, Kathy Nelson, an electrical engineer who loves to hear and share stories of other women in STEM. Well, I'm really excited for today's guest. I got to go back to college. Not my college, but today's conversation brought back so many college experiences and the atmosphere back to my memory. I sat down with Dr. Linda Shadler, who is the Dean of Engineering and Mathematical Sciences at the University of Vermont. She shares how she became a dean, and quite honestly, I didn't know exactly what a dean does. I feel like I should. I went to college. I put a couple of kids through college. My dad was a professor, but honestly, I hadn't really thought too much about what they actually do. Other than the fact that I know they were pretty high up in the hierarchy of a university. So she clarifies what a dean does and what she does as a dean, specifically. She also shares how she got involved in material science and what brought her into academia. I really had an absolutely delightful conversation, and I'm so excited to share her story. Hey, Linda. So how are you doing? It's been a few months since we talked.
Yeah, all is well.
Good.
Had a good holiday break. UVM shuts down for real, like no emails or anything for a week, so it's great.
Oh, that's nice. I work for a consulting firm and we close between Christmas and New Year's too. I mean, if you have like a client that you have to work with, you have to work, but same thing. And it's so nice because you don't come back to 1,000 emails, you know, piled up. And I don't know about you, but I binge watched Netflix over the holidays. I did nothing. Like we had one day that we went to my in-laws on the other side of the state. Otherwise, I literally did nothing. And well, that's not totally true. I did a little bit of cleaning, but you know, we didn't go anywhere and it was nice.
Yeah, it was pretty quiet for us too. Yeah.
Have you been doing any running? Because we talked about this last time. Are you running? Are you doing any races or anything?
No. I mean, I'm biking and swimming and doing a lot of Nordic skiing, but no racing.
Okay.
Not sure I'll ever race again. Maybe something silly, a little small, but yeah.
Okay, so I would actually say the same thing, except for, so there's a woman that I've done all my destination marathons with, and we had decided long ago when we did our first one, which was like, I don't know, like 2000-ish timeframe, that when she was, so she's 15 years older than me, that when she's 70 and I'm 55, that we would do another marathon, which seemed like a great idea like 20 years ago, right? Now I'm like, damn, that's kind of like, I don't know that I want to do that. And so she had brought that up earlier this year. She's like, you know, we got to start thinking about that. It's not that far away. And then my daughter, so I was telling my daughter, and this is my daughter that was having the migraine issues. I said something to her about Winnie bringing that up. And she's like, well, Mom, I always thought that we would run a marathon together. And I'm like, damn it. I don't want to run two. So now I'm planning to run a marathon with her this fall, but we haven't decided which one yet. We had like one picked out and then it got canceled last year. So I don't know if they're going to do it this year. And then I had a friend who was like, well, as long as you're training for a marathon this fall, there's this great 10 miler, cherry blossom 10 miler in Washington that you should come do. And I'm like, well, that might be kind of nice. And I haven't been to Washington in the spring when the cherry blossoms are out, but it was a lottery. And so then and you have to remember, like, I mean, I know Vermont is also cold, but it's like, we get down to like 30 below here, like actual temperature. It can be like really rough in Minnesota. So today we just found out that we got in through the lottery to this 10 miler in DC. So I now have to start a training schedule next Monday and it's not supposed to be very warm.
elliptical.
Well, okay. So here's the thing. I live in a very remote area. The closest gym is the gym my husband goes to, and it's like 20 minutes each direction at least. So it's like, it's almost like an hour on either side to go to the gym. And I don't have the time. So I'm like, I'm just going to suck it up, go outside. I used to have a treadmill in the house. We don't have a treadmill in the house anymore. I'm at least doing three more races in my life, but I'm not very happy about it. It sounds terrible.
You'll have fun with your folks.
Yeah, it should be good. How is cross-country skiing out there? I mean, I'm assuming it's probably great. I mean, it's a beautiful area.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And we do some backcountry skiing. I'll get into the backcountry this weekend. So
do you have like cabins and stuff like that that you can go between when you do like backcountry?
You can, but not like Maine or Colorado. They're really just starting to build the hut system in Vermont. So
okay, because yeah. My daughter will do that. All of my kids did Nordic skiing in like middle school and high school. Not so much my son. He did like a few years because we made him and bribed him, but my daughters did. And now my daughters go to school in Bozeman, and my oldest will do backcountry and like go stay at huts, both for like downhill and for cross country. And it's just, it's amazing to me that I have like raised kids that do that and are that adventurous, because I'm not. And I will cross country ski, but I'm not pretty. Like it's not a good look. My kids look like little battle ballerinas out there, and I'm just like struggling. I look like I don't even know what they could equate it to, but it's a good way to get exercise though. And it's, you know, a sport you can do for lifetime. And
yeah. Yeah.
So good. No, for you. Great.
You don't have to be fast to enjoy it.
Yeah. And I go, like, I live on a lake, so I'll go out on the lake, which works out fine unless the lake is slushy, which was what happened the last time I went. And that is not so great, but it's fun. And it's a good way to get some exercise when it's cold.
It's a good alternative to running.
It is. I might work that in with my running in the next couple, at least like for the start of my training schedule. Okay, so let's talk about you and what you do. So you are the dean of the College of Engineering and Mathematical Sciences at University of Vermont. So I know what professors do. I honestly don't really know what a dean does. What do you do as a dean?
That is a really great question. Sometimes I ask myself that at the end of the day. So a dean sets a strategy for the college. The dean, the department chairs report into the dean. So when a department is trying to hire new people or change a curriculum or invest in a new program, it needs cooperation and support and resources from a dean. So you're really driving the college progress and strategic vision.
So would you be kind of like a manager, director, vice president, if you were to like equate it to like, you know, like the business world, would it be kind of like that?
It would certainly be like a manager and a senior leader. Yes.
Okay. So how do you go from being, so I'm assuming that you were a professor before you were a dean.
Yes. Yes, I was a professor and taught for 20 years.
So how do you go from being a professor to a dean? And was that a path that you specifically set out for, or was it just kind of like you fell into it, or how did that happen?
So when I was young and naive, I thought, oh, I want to be a president of a university. And then I learned more about what presidents of universities do, which is more around the fundraising and the public part of being of running a university. And I quickly decided that was not something I wanted to do. And so I just sort of was being a faculty member, and I was successful. I had a pretty big research group. And I was asked to run a program that mentored junior faculty. And I met with the dean as part of that program, telling the dean what I'd learned and what I thought needed to happen. And while I was doing that, the dean said to me, why don't you apply to be an associate dean? And I was shocked, because that's not something I'd really thought about. But I really liked this dean, and I applied and I got the job, and I was an associate dean of academic affairs, which meant I had a lot of impact on curriculum and faculty hiring and faculty mentoring. And I realized that in a leadership position, you have more impact than you can have as an individual faculty member. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated that impact. So then I went from there to a vice provost of undergraduate education, where I could impact the whole campus in terms of education and classroom quality and active learning and project-based learning. Then I applied to be the dean at that same university and was turned down. And that got me looking other places. And so then I ended up at the University of Vermont as a dean. And that's not the typical route. The typical route is department chair to dean, but that's the route I took. Yeah. Okay.
From a standpoint of being a dean of an engineering department?
College.
Okay. Dean of a college. How is that from being a female? Because so let me preface this with the college that I went to. So I'm an electrical engineer. I went to North Dakota State University. And I think we had one professor that was female. And I think when I went to look, when I started doing this podcast, and I went to look to see if there's any professors from my college that I should interview, there weren't any. So how is that from a standpoint of academia in an engineering college, from women? And is it a pipeline issue from your perspective, or is it a women don't want to go into academia? Or maybe you have a great department of wonderful women professors.
No, we don't. Let's see. How has it been? So I was the first woman hired in my department in my first job, which was at Drexel University. I was the first woman to get tenure in my department at RPI in materials engineering. I was the first woman, I believe the first full or second full professor woman in the college. I was the first chaired professor in engineering, which is sort of above full professor. You can get these endowed professorships. I was the first woman this, first woman that. So I was definitely in a world of men the whole time. I've been a tomboy my whole life, and I don't wear makeup. I've had the same haircut for 25 years. So in some ways, what people think of me has just never been a big part of my life. So I think I found it easier than a lot of people to just bust through the barriers and not really worry. But it's not that it didn't have impact. There's certainly cultural things that impacted my success and how much I was enjoying the job. And I think in general, what we've learned is that there are a lot of women who go and get PhDs, but then first of all, we lose them from undergrad into PhD, which is what you need to be a professor, mm-hmm. because of those sort of, I guess people might call them microaggressions or just discomfort being in an all-male world, or they get attracted into industry where they can be paid a lot more. Mm-hmm. Those that do get PhDs, then there's that next layer of microaggression. And so there does turn out to be a pipeline problem all the way up through full professor. So sometimes we hire women at the assistant professor level and they don't make it to the next, you know, the next promotional levels. They don't get tenure, which was that job I had initially where I was a coach for junior faculty to help women get tenure. Mm. So there's a lot of programs trying to help fix that. Progress is slow. Progress is fastest at the highest ranked universities because they pay the best.
Oh, okay.
So they attract, they can really attract whoever they want. And so there's more progress there. There's also more women in the engineering sciences that have really obvious societal impact, like biomedical engineering and environmental engineering. Mm-hmm. Whereas the more electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, it's still farther behind in terms of reaching equity.
So far behind.
And I'll tell you, it's even worse for faculty of color. The numbers for faculty of color in the STEM disciplines is even less impressive than it is for women in those disciplines.
So, well, I got a couple of questions that this comes to mind. Have you found any programming or systemic changes that you can make to, I don't want to say alleviate, help with, it's not really that, because I know it's very, very small, like, any changes that you make are, you know, they're not making drastic impact and takes a very long time, but are there programs that you have seen be effective at having some growth?
Absolutely. So one of the key things that's changing is hiring practices so that there's less bias in the hiring. So more women are being hired because they are floating to the top of the list of, you know, top candidates for a position because the hiring practices have changed. Same with faculty of color. There's been big changes in parental leave policies, ability to delay your tenure clock. That really makes it more family friendly, both for the men and the women, but that's helped keep women in the field. There are support programs for women in a variety of ways, colleges that put daycares on campus. You know, those kind of things make a big difference. It makes it easier to be a professor, which is really kind of a 24/7 job, and be a parent.
What made you decide that you wanted to be a professor or even just like progress from an undergrad degree to getting your PhD? Like, what was that path like for you?
So my mother got her PhD when I was in middle school. My father has a PhD. So I always knew that that was a possibility. My uncle is a college professor, my mother was a college professor. But what really sealed the deal for me was a course I took my senior year in college where you had to research a topic and then you gave a lecture to the class.
Oh.
I stood up in front of the class and watched my colleagues learn from me, and I just knew that that's what I wanted to do.
That's awesome. I don't I haven't heard of a class like that. Like not when I was in college anyway. That's great. I think that's I mean that's a great opportunity.
Yeah, so we learned state-of-the-art topics because everybody had to be reading research papers, and you got practice presenting and learning how to write a real full kind of proposal. Yeah, it was great.
Well, and probably two of the most important skills that so I was in college between 89 and 93. There was no verbal communication requirement. There was no technical writing requirement. And at my job, for probably the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, all I do is write and present. And I've hired communication coaches, you know, all things that should be being taught and practiced, not necessarily even taught, but practiced and modeled and given opportunities for from the very beginning of not even college, but you know, in I want to say, I guess maybe it does start with like show and tell, right? But you know, but keeping doing that like through all the different levels so that you're comfortable with it. And I also think that that's, you know, such a challenge for technical people in general to be good at it. You know, like we have all sat through just, you know, painful technical presentations where you just want to poke yourself in the eye because it's so hard to listen to. And I never want to be one of those people, you know, like I so having those skills and being able to practice that and, you know, have the opportunity to give a lecture, that's something I haven't done, I guess, unless you consider a technical presentation for 45 minutes. I suppose it's probably the same thing, but that sounds like a fabulous opportunity. Do you model that and do that in your school?
We have a lot of focus on presentation. I think most universities at this point do in their colleges of
Oh, thank
education,
goodness.
of engineering. ABET, the accrediting body, really requires communication skills for engineering departments now.
That's a great thing. That makes me really happy.
It doesn't mean that everybody gets good at it, but they're given
No.
the opportunity to get good at it, so.
Well, and I mean, they have to get better. I hope you're enjoying this podcast and Linda's story. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support it, head over to your favorite podcast platform where you can rate it, or even better, write a review, which will help other people find my podcast and bring these women's stories to more listeners. You can also find me, Kathy Nelson, at www.ordinarily-extraordinary.com. Thanks, and back to Linda's story. Okay, so you talked about your parents being professors and your mom getting her PhD when you were in middle school, which that actually sounds really like, well, it sounds really cool from a standpoint of like being a strong female presence, but from also being a middle school person, you probably want your mom like there going to your stuff and making you dinner. Was that, how was that?
So she was working and getting degrees from when I was in kindergarten. And actually, I went to an after school program in kindergarten. I had the morning kindergarten class and I had to go to the neighbor's house in the afternoons. And in first grade, I told her I wouldn't do that anymore. So I went home after school, starting in first grade, and somehow she figured out people to be around. She usually got home like an hour and a half later because she was usually teaching labs. And I went home, and then by about third grade, I think I know in second grade, I called her when I got off the bus every day. I'm sure this social services would have come in had they known, but I got off the bus. She called. I had to answer the phone, and then she knew I was okay. The neighbors were around if I needed them, and I had to do certain things. I wasn't allowed to go running around the neighborhood, but I didn't have to go to the after school programs. And I remember it distinctly that by then I was on my own because one day she called and I started to cry as soon as I picked up the phone and she was very worried, what's wrong? Well, I had wet my pants and I knew that if I didn't answer the phone, she would be mad and worried but I needed to go to the bathroom, I guess. And so I wet my pants as a 7-year-old. So yeah, it was not necessarily easy, but I guess it had been that way my whole life. And so I didn't really think about it from the perspective of me needing her around more.
Did it give you, and probably not at the time, but like when you like look back on it, when you were thinking about what you wanted to do and what, you know, you could do and your opportunities, did the fact that she was a strong female presence, did that contribute to what you went into and your life choices?
Oh, absolutely. And I also have other very strong females in my family who were very, very supportive. But I also had a role model. I knew it could be done. Mm-hmm.
What about your dad? Like, so was your dad supportive of your mom going to school and working? And like, was he involved in like more of the traditional female roles at that time?
No, my husband was, but no, my mother did it all. He was very supportive of my mother. When they were first married, they lived in a duplex, and the other couple got divorced because the woman was so bored. And so my father said to my mother, do whatever you want so that you're not bored, because he loved her so much. So it was against all that he knew and all his tradition. But because of his love for her, he was very supportive of it. But he did not step in and do the cooking and the laundry, no.
Did that have an impact on like how you wanted to like model your family when you were being a professor and having a family and things like that?
Yeah, my husband and I had several conversations before we got engaged about some values we would have as a couple. And one of them was family first, careers second. Mm. So that meant there were times when I was trying to get tenure where he was doing more of the support at home. And then there were times where he was in a push and I was doing more of the support at home, but it was very much a partnership in being a family.
That seems like a very excellent conversation to have before one gets married. And I don't know, like I was 22 when I got married. My husband and I did not have that conversation. We were young. I will always say that we were too young to get married. We got married right out of college and you don't even know who you are, let alone, you know, what you're looking for in life. And I think that, honestly, I think that's great advice, you know, to have those conversations so that you can make sure that you're on the same page. And, you know, my husband's been great. He's been super supportive. He cooks, he cleans, I will say though, he does all the car stuff and most of the outside stuff. So I'm probably a little traditional in that, more so than he is, because he'll do the cooking, the laundry, house cleaning, you know, it's, you know, me. And we never talked about it. It just like kind of fell into place, fortunately. But, you know, it's such a struggle for so many people that it can really detract from happiness for sure. And success and, you know, all the things that, you know, we want to have as women. Okay. So you have a bachelor's degree in materials science. So what were you interested in as a kid that made you want to go into materials science? And, I didn't know what an electrical engineer was when I was going to school to be an electrical engineer. I'm not sure I know what a material scientist is now.
So I did not grow up dreaming of being a material scientist. as I mentioned, I was a tomboy. I loved being outside. I loved animals. And I thought I wanted to be a biologist. And I took AP biology my senior year in high school. And it seemed to me that biology was just memorizing things, which of course it's not, but that's how I felt about it at the time. And so just as I was about to put in applications to college, I said, I'm going to be an engineer instead. I didn't know really what that meant either. Mm-hmm. But I said, I'm going to be a chemical engineer because I liked my chemistry class. And so I started as a chemical engineer. And I took this course that they teach in chemical engineering, which is basically what goes in is what comes out, right? Conservation of mass, conservation of energy. And wow, that really did not seem like an exciting field to work in, which of course was also false. I mean, chemical engineering is fascinating, especially where it connects into biological processing. But I took a course where we made samples of materials and we broke them. And then we tried to understand why at the atomic level they broke. Hmm. So if you think about it, the chemistry, the biology, that's all molecules mm-hmm. And so this was really connecting molecular behavior to macroscopic behavior that I could see. And I said, wow, this is fascinating. And so I went home and I said, I'm going to switch my major from chemical engineering to materials engineering. And my father said, that's what I am. I'm a materials engineer.
Oh my gosh, seriously?
And he'd never really talked about his technical work. He always talked about his work as a manager. So I quickly understood.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And materials engineering is designing new materials that have new properties. So it doesn't have to be mechanical properties like strength and ductility and toughness. It could be that they're transparent conducting materials or have a higher index of refraction so they can help pull more light out of light emitting diodes, or, you know, all kinds of properties. Everything that you have in front of you right now, everything from your microphone to your chair is made out of a material for a very specific reason. And so that's what materials engineers do, is figure out the best material and learn how to make new ones.
Okay. So when you were going to school to be a material scientist, did you think you were going to go into industry, or were you already thinking about grad school and, you know, postgraduate work?
I was still conflicted about industry or academia. As I said, I hadn't really thought about academia until my senior year. But I was pretty sure I was going to go to graduate school. And again, that's just the family culture.
My dad has a doctorate and I stopped at my bachelor's.
Well, honestly, my son, who graduated a few years ago, we really encouraged him to go work in industry before deciding to get a PhD, because we had so many colleagues. I met my husband in graduate school. We had so many colleagues in graduate school who didn't know why they were there. They just thought it was the next step, right? Whereas I knew I wanted to be a professor. That's why I was there. And he has taken a few years. He's in an engineering leadership development program. And as part of that, they get a master's degree. But now he's thinking about going to get a PhD because he wants to stay on the technical track in industry. Mm. And so if you want to be a technical manager in the field he's in, you really need a PhD. But now, you know, it'll be 5 years after he graduated. He'll know why he's doing it. He'll know exactly what he wants to study. So I'm not a big fan of people going directly into PhDs.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because I completely agree with you that not having the experience of being in industry and then going into, probably more so the route of teaching without having any industry background, I also think is not necessarily great, because you're teaching people who are probably going to go into industry. And without having any industry experience to talk about, I think that's hard.
Yeah. So that's why I went to IBM for a couple of years after grad school, was to get a little bit of industry experience before I went to teach. I do agree that industry experience is really helpful.
It's also, I can also, as I'm saying that, also understand the side of like, it's so broad, right? Like there's probably 30,000 jobs you can have as an electrical engineer. So having one of them before you teach is not really like necessarily bringing a whole lot to the plate either, because there's a ton of different things that you can do.
Yeah. But it gives you a perspective that I think is helpful to students.
Yeah. Do you think that by you being the dean and in leadership and as a professor, do you think that just by you being there as a female, do you think that that's brought more women into the colleges that you and into the programs that you have been involved in?
I don't know that it's brought more women in, me being a dean. I do think there's been parts of my career where I've helped expose women to STEM and encourage them in STEM. But I do think that the women in the college recognize that now there's a role model that's a woman. Mm-hmm. And I think they appreciate that, even if they don't interact with me much. And I've certainly not all of them, but I've certainly gotten comments from students that they really appreciate that there's some of the college leadership is female.
Well, and I certainly didn't pick my college. Well, I don't know that I had a whole lot of choice in my college. I went to a college that was in the town that I grew up in, but I think if I had my choice, that would be something that I would look for. But that's also, you know, like looking back on things, you know, 30 years after graduating from college. But I think it's really important to be able to have you can't be what you can't see, right? And to see like women teaching and leading and stuff for most women and men, you know, this is their first exposure to somebody who has the degrees that they are seeking. And I think, you know, having women in those roles is super, super important. And so I have to say, when I went back to look at my college a couple of months ago and didn't see any women faculty in electrical engineering, I was mortified. I was like, this is 30 years later. How are there less? I mean, there was only one before, but now there's zero.
Well, and I will say that there have been a lot of women hired into the college since I got into my position as dean.
Good.
Yeah. So I perhaps push on it a little harder than previous deans.
It needs to be pushed.
Yes, it does.
What are you most proud of in your career so far?
So probably two things. One is a course I used to teach in the junior level that really brought together a lot of what the students had already learned in the degree and had them apply it. And it was a really hard course, but they had to learn to write. They had to do an independent project as part of it. Like, I gave them a material and I said, figure out how to make it stronger. By the end, you know, they learned a bunch of things, and then I did that. And they would write to me often about how hard the course was, but how it was the first time they felt like materials engineers and that it was the most useful course they took, or one of the most useful courses they took. And so I influenced a lot of students that way. And so I'm pretty proud of that course and the impact it had. The other thing I'm really proud of is a project I was involved in called the Molecularium. So a molecularium is a planetarium, but instead of looking at the stars, you take a journey down into the world of atoms and molecules, you know, think the Magic School Bus or something.
Oh, interesting.
And we targeted it towards K through five, and then a second version of it that was more like fourth through eighth graders. And it was kind of at the time when the technology was developing, so it ended up being an animated show, whereas old planetarium shows were just these green and black lines. And I took the risk to buy that kind of projector and hire an unknown person who could do that kind of work. And with my colleagues, we created a planetarium show that was translated into three or four different languages, went all around the world, won a bunch of awards. And then someone saw it and they gave us the money to turn it into a giant screen cinema. So, you know, like an IMAX. That was translated into three or four languages and went all around the world. And so probably several hundred thousand people got exposure to materials engineering and this key concept that everything is made of atoms and molecules, and solids slow, liquids flow, gases fast, right? So the atoms in a solid hardly move at all. That's why they're solid. And in a liquid, they flow. That's why a liquid flows. And in a gas, they move around really fast. and so some connection between a property and an atomic structure. And I think for the little kids I know who loved it, when they then took chemistry, it was a breeze because they already understood how to abstract from the macroscopic down into that. So pretty proud of that. It was with several colleagues and ultimately probably 100 people worked on the project. So I can't take full credit, but I was a big part of the team and I'm pretty proud of it.
That sounds really fun. Like, I want to go. That actually might have helped me in chemistry, because chemistry was not my strong suit by any stretch of the imagination. There's a reason I'm an electrical engineer. Physics, calculus, those were my things. Chemistry, biology, those were not my strong suits. So, but maybe if I had gone to that, maybe I would have had a better understanding, because I still don't understand chemistry. My kids would come to and ask me, you know, questions and for help and stuff when they were taking chemistry, and I'm like, I can put you in contact with some really smart people. I am not them.
Yeah, it's hard to abstract those concepts. So, and I mean, it was 20 years ago. The films are now, they're not out of date, but you know, they've had their time, but it was a lot of fun.
It sounds really cool. And you know what you just made me think of, you know, the Van Gogh experience that's going around right now. Was it kind of like that? Cause I almost feel like you could take something like the Van Gogh experience and bring it into, like, you know, a scientific aspect to it and do something like that.
Yeah, you basically immerse people as if they're an atom sitting in with all the other atoms sitting around them. And there's a tool called molecular dynamics that models the correct motion of atoms. And we used that and just translated from this very scientific tool into an animation tool And so you were really seeing what it would have been like to be sitting on an atom inside those materials. So
It
same kind
sounds
of
really
immersion.
cool. It sounds
Yeah,
really neat.
it's pretty cool.
And you're making me, so now you also just made me think of a question that I kind of wish that I have like had asked all of my podcast guests. What's the most fun that you've had at work?
What's the most fun I've had at work?
Because that sounds really fun to me.
Yeah, I mean, at times it was really, really fun. We were bringing artists, computer science people, material scientists, chemical engineers all together. And so when you're trying to do that kind of interdisciplinary work, there's also plenty of frustration
Oh, for
because,
sure. Yeah.
yeah, you figure out the language. And but it was fascinating to watch the process. What is the most fun? I really think the most fun I've had is with the students. So when I'm teaching and it's going well and the students are having fun and I'm having fun, there's really nothing like it. But I think other times when I'm in a creative space and creative things are happening and you're interacting with people to create, anytime that I'm doing that is fun.
What do you want to do in the rest of your career? Like, do you have goals that you still want to achieve or things you want to do, like with your college or?
So, are you familiar with the Peter Principle?
I am not.
So, the Peter Principle says that people are going to be promoted one step past their competency.
Okay.
They're good at their job, so you promote them, and then all of a sudden they're not good at their job anymore. So, I feel like if I were to be promoted one more time, that I would have reached the Peter Principle, and that Dean is the right ending to my career.
What would be after Dean?
Provost, which is the chief academic officer for the whole university.
Okay.
And I just think that my personality and all that public facing would be a tough match. But in my current job, I certainly still have a lot of goals. We're in the middle of a curricular transformation for undergraduates to make it more active learning, more project-based learning. We're on a path for making the college more inclusive and have everybody feel belonging and success. So some equity for all students, no matter income level, gender, race, et cetera, that I'm really passionate about. That includes hiring of faculty. I'm really passionate about some of the research areas that we're growing. I have faculty who are really critical in some of the new ideas for creating renewable energy utilities that are stable and can serve large audiences. And that's going to be critical for affecting reducing climate impacts. I have faculty doing really, really interesting work in the biomedical engineering space. So I'm just really passionate about building these teams of researchers who can go on and impact the world in ways I can't, because it's not my field. But as the dean, I'm help putting these teams together and finding them support. So I'm really passionate about that. And the state of Vermont needs a university that is really strong in STEM and is helping the K-12 educators become better STEM educators. So I'm also really passionate about some of our programs in that space. So I feel like I have a lot to do still as a dean, but
That's a
after
lot of stuff
that,
you got going on.
yeah. And then I'm gonna maybe step back into the classroom for a couple of years, but it won't be long after that that I retire. My husband's already retired, so every day he's out playing tennis and skiing, and I'm going to work.
Oh gosh, that's rough.
Well, but he also does the laundry and he cooks my food and takes care of the cars and does the outside work now. So he's actually kind of being a stay-at-home mom, if you will, for
So does
just
he
the
have
last
dinner on the
couple of
table
years.
when you come home from work?
Yes.
Yeah, my husband was so there was a time in my life that like after my second two kids, I went to part-time for like a year and my husband did shift work, so he did like 3 12-hour shifts. And so I would, well, maybe this is when I was working. No, this is when I was working part time. So he would come home, the house would be a mess. The kids would be probably not even have clothes on. There's no dinner anywhere near the table. And then the days that he's home, dinner's on the table, the kids are dressed, the house is clean. And I'm like, all those typical stereotypes. I'm like, yeah, I like to think I was playing with the kids. That's my reasoning behind it anyway. And he was more focused on making sure everything was cleaned up and neat and everything. But yeah, it is nice to come home from work though and have dinner on the table.
Absolutely. I have to do the dishes, though.
Oh, you know, we do that too. Like whoever cooks, the other person has to clean.
Seems only fair.
What advice do you have for girls or young women thinking about going into STEM?
If you are passionate about trying to change the world, you should go into STEM. And don't let how many women are in STEM stop you. You should follow your passions.
Okay, and then I may have one more question for you, because I have, so my daughter and I toured UVM when she was looking at colleges, she ended up not going. She ended up going out to Bozeman, where my other daughter went. What do you like about UVM and about, you know, the college and then, well, the university and then your specific college? Like what are your favorite parts about UVM?
So I really like UVM. I love the leadership culture, which is incredibly collaborative, and that benefits students, because if they want to do something in an interdisciplinary way, then that pathway is already smooth for them. I love how truly committed the faculty and the staff are to the students and to student success. So they bend over backwards for students. I love the student population. They're really well-rounded. They're really articulate. They're really bright. They're really committed to their passions. So it makes it a really, and as I said, the leadership culture is very collaborative. So the other deans and I, we have a great time. So it's just a fun place to work. In terms of from a student perspective, what I love about my college, we have two brand new buildings. We have a completely renovated engineering building. We have all new undergraduate laboratory equipment. So there's a beautiful space to study in. And as I mentioned, the faculty are constantly improving their classroom teaching and lately building more project-based courses and active learning courses so that you're not sitting still as often, you're engaged more and more. And we're a size, you know, many engineering colleges, it's, I don't know, 800 students in a, so 3,000 and larger is a typical engineering college. We are 1,500 students, and that includes computer science, mathematics, and statistics and our engineering departments. So your biggest class size is maybe 60, maybe 70, and very quickly it's down to 30, 35. Mm-hmm. So you really get to interact with the faculty. Anybody who wants to do research gets to try it out. We pay for students to do that. So it's a really personable place and an easy place for interaction. Yeah, I mean, I guess I could say more about the quality of the faculty, but that's probably true anywhere. But there are some really unique things at UVM in terms of commitment to the environment, commitment to renewable energy, commitment to health and well-being of humankind.
Okay, and then you just made me think of another question that I have, which is, why is it called UVM?
It means University of the Green Mountains. So what is that?
Is it Latin? Is that what it comes from? Montes
or something.
Yeah. Okay. I think there's a sign on campus. I think now you just like made me like recall that. I think there's a sign on campus that I saw that maybe said that. But
yeah,
that was
University of Montes. Yep.
Okay. Cause that was a very like puzzling thing when we were first like planning to go out there to tour, especially being from the Midwest. We don't, you know, we're not exposed to University of Vermont very often. And so when my daughter was going back, like UVM, I'm like, that's not their abbreviation. Like, why is it UVM? Well, I have had just a delight talking with you. I thank you so much for being on the podcast. And I am so glad that we got to touch base. And I thank you for giving me like the couple of months that I took off from when we first had originally scheduled this. So thank you. This has been a great deal of fun. You made me want to go back to school, which I have to say, like at my age, like that's not something I say lightly and not something I would actually do, but you're just like taking me back to my college years and the fun that you can have at it. So I'm so glad that I got the opportunity to talk with you.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad we got a chance to talk and I'm glad your daughter's doing better. And thank you for being patient with me tonight as I had to pop off. So.
Oh, of course.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. You can find a list of definitions, acronyms, and a fact check in the episode notes. If you like this podcast, please like it and write a review. And if you'd like to have more episodes delivered right to you, please feel free to hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. And please join me for future episodes. Thank you.